Well, hello, good morning. It's Abbey 104. It's Sunday morning. It's time for Folk Tales. I'm Terry Bennett, and in the studio today I have John Jackson. Good morning, John.
Good morning, Terry.
Good morning. Now, you are what's described as an international independent consultant, which I guess could be any number of things, but just tell us what you do.
Well, I'm employed for short-term contracts by Council of Europe and one or two other international organisations to help strengthen local authorities in Eastern Europe and beyond. So next week, for example, or 2 weeks' time, I have to go to Ukraine. I've been deeply involved in Ukraine in the decentralisation programme. And in Ukraine, I'm involved in developing a system for local government training as a whole new reform of local government that's going on there. I'm also running a leadership academy for the administration that is responsible for decentralization, so they can begin to look at decentralization from the perspective of the local authorities, and hopefully we get a better relationship between the state and the local authorities.
This is something quite specialist, isn't it? And I think we'll probably find out as we go along that you have a career in the civil service and in related subjects that have helped you get into this position.
Yes, I started as a teacher. I've moved into youth work. I've worked in local government and central government. Mm. And this is really the finale of my working life.
Okay. Well, we'll come back and have a chat about how you got to that stage, and we'll wander through your early life as well. But let's take your first record, which is Harry Belafonte and a Jamaica Farewell. This means something, clearly.
It does. I had an American step-grandmother, and she lived in New York, and we only saw her once or twice, but I remember her coming over to England in 1955. I was 10 then, and she bought our first LPs. And this was one of the four LPs she bought us.
Okay.
Down the way where the nights are gay and the sun shines daily on the mountain top, I took a trip on a sailing ship, and when I reached Jamaica, I made a stop. But I'm sad to say I'm on my way, won't be back for many a day. My heart is down, my head is turning around, I had to leave a little girl in Kingston Town. Sounds of laughter everywhere and the dancing girls swaying to and fro. I must declare my heart is there, though I've been from Maine to Mexico. But I'm sad to say I'm on my way, won't be back for many a day. My heart is down, my head is turning around, I had to leave a little girl in Kingston Town. Down at the market you can hear ladies cry out while on their heads they bear. Ackee, rice, salt fish are nice and the rum is fine any time of year. But I'm sad to say I'm on my way, won't be back for many a day.
The Jamaica Farewell with Harry Belafonte from 1957, chosen by my guest in the Folk Tales studio today. That's John Jackson. John, we'll come back and talk about your career and how you became an independent consultant, ultimately. But let's go back to your early days. You grew up in Hampshire, I believe.
Yes. I was dropped in the New Forest.
Okay.
Then my father was a vicar. And vicar's wife, they're a really good couple, as you know, as priests go. They love their work and they're appreciated. We moved to Beaconsfield when I was 6 months for his curacy, just for 4 years. Then we came back to Hampshire, and he spent the rest of his life in the Winchester Diocese. So the first one was Thruxton, Fifield and Kympton, the villages where Thruxton Circuit, people may know of the Thruxton Circuit.
Well, indeed, it passes on the A303, don't you?
Absolutely.
As you head Londonward.
Absolutely. And I remember we used to climb a tree and look over the Thruxton Circuit from the top of the tree and watch the motorbike racing. And the only name I remember is John Surtees from that time.
So early memories of looking over Thruxton Circuit. But you must have moved around a fair amount, did you?
Not really. At that time, it was a big house, no heating. This is a memory of early memory. We had 5 blankets on the bed. There was ice on the windows on the inside when we woke up. No money, not much money around, so we didn't need to go for holidays. It was, you know, a nice garden, etc. Used our bikes, go around the country villages. And then we moved to Oakley, near Basingstoke, for 10 years, and Wootton St Lawrence. And then my father finally ended up in Westcliff, just to the west of Bournemouth.
In the Bournemouth suburbs, yes.
So we were just on the cliff overlooking the beach, which was a delightful way of life.
So what was it like being the son of a vicar, basically? You were one of 4, weren't you? So,
yes. I have an elder brother, Richard.
Right.
At the age of 14, he knew he wanted to go into the Navy. He went into the Navy, retired as a commander, and now lives in Chichester with his boat, naturally. My younger brother, Anthony, he became a chief engineer with Maersk Shipping, but he lived in Brazil and spent his life in Brazil. He died a couple of years ago. And my sister, Rosalind, and she married early, had a family, loves painting, and lives in Clevedon.
And Mum was a vicar's wife, presumably.
And Mum was a vicar's wife, yes. And looked after us and cooked for us and everything else. Wonderful.
And attended parish functions and everything else that vicar's wives were supposed to do.
Chaired committees. Yes. And I think my father liked most the ministry side. And I remember seeing a letter on his desk from one of the parishioners saying, I'm so grateful that you were able to help me as my husband died. Without your presence, I wouldn't have been able to manage. And that kind of gave me an insight into the value of this kind of work, and of both of them, both my mother and my father.
Happy memories of childhood then, generally?
Very happy memories. Mm. It was really trouble-free, cash-free, trouble-free, and lots of fun adventure.
That's good. But you eventually went away to school, didn't you?
Yes. When I was 13, I went to St John's School in Leatherhead. St John's, they do a special deal for the children of vicars. So it was boarding, and I was there till I was 19. And that was also a very happy experience.
Was that a prospect you welcomed? You moved away from home, was it?
I was happy. I was happy doing this. I was good at sport, and that helped. I was better at sport than I was at academics.
I see.
My last year, I was playing cricket 20 hours a week, and then playing rugby and fives and athletics. So it's all sport. and then I stayed on. At the age of 18, the headmaster asked me to stay on as head boy. And that was my first probably experience of responsibility. And what was interesting was that Field Marshal Montgomery had become our chairman. After he left the army, he was looking around schools, and he saw our CCF at work, and our headmaster said, I'd like to be your chairman. Who could say no? and that summer, he would bring a guest to give away the prizes at prize giving. And so there was on the top table, headmaster, myself, because I had to make a speech too, Field Marshal Montgomery and Clement Attlee, because Clement Attlee was the guest that year. He was getting old then, getting older. I still remember seeing them scratching and they want a cup of tea. This is the first time I've seen people come down from the one-inch headlines in the newspapers to reality. And I said they're just ordinary people, and that's when I first began to believe that if they can do it, other people, anybody can do it. You know, what's special about reaching the top. How do you reach the top? Everybody has so much talent, and I suppose this was part of the drivers that led me in the direction I went.
Hmm. So you actually did an extra year at school, effectively, as head boy.
Yes,
but you had A-levels then.
Yes, and I'd taken A-levels.
Presumably you had in mind university. Did you have any career ambitions at that point?
No.
I
didn't know what I was going to do. I went on to Durham University to read anthropology. And 3 months before I graduated, still not knowing what I was going to do, Chaplin said, come and meet a friend of mine, come and have tea and meet a friend of mine. And the friend happened to be, goes back to a link with school. One of the boys in my school in the 1930s, called Vivian Redlich, had gone as a priest to Papua New Guinea, worked for the Papua New Guinea mission. And instead of going back to Australia in 42, when the Japanese invaded, he'd stayed behind and he'd been caught and executed. So the school remembered Vivian Redlich, and the person who the chaplain invited me to meet at tea was the secretary of the New Guinea mission, who'd been a missionary also since the war in Papua New Guinea. And so he said, we need teachers in the high school in Papua New Guinea. And I said, all right, I'll come. It was the country's first high school, set up as a memorial to those like Vivian Redlich who'd been martyred in the war. And so I went and spent 4 happy years teaching at that school in the jungle.
Something really just of a coincidence that happened to come along. So this wasn't really preordained at all. It was just happened.
Quite, yes.
Were you ever tempted to follow your father into the ministry?
A little bit, but that temptation didn't survive. Mm. And when I was teaching, I was there as a lay mission teacher. But I was interested in the conversion process. Because of my anthropology, I'd learnt to cross cultures. And so for me, I was happy crossing into the Papua New Guinea culture. And I spent all the holidays, because I didn't come back for 4 years, I spent all the holidays in the villages with my students as their guests. And we were walking the Kokoda track. The Japanese, when they landed on the north coast of Papua New Guinea, they walked across the mountains to try and capture Australia, and they got 30 kilometres from Port Moresby. That was how close they were to taking on Australia before they were pushed back. Some of the old people I knew, I met, remember the Japanese, and I was piloting a social science curriculum at the time as well for high schools, across other high schools across the country. And I'd spent a lot of time in the villages talking with the old people, with my students and the old people about first Europeans. What do they expect of education? What do they want their children to do? How do they see the world changing? It was a very, very interesting time for someone who had that background.
I'm sure it was. I mean, quite a change, quite a cultural shock, I would have thought, having come from Durham and before that Thruxton and Westbourne and places. You adapted to it okay, though?
Yes, I think my anthropology got me involved in the process of change in these countries. And Papua New Guinea, the students, the grandparents of the students I was teaching, they had been cannibals. And now these students were going on to university. And so imagine the polarization within a family of a student who, one of my students, became the first commercial pilot. They go back to their villages at Christmas and sitting with their grandparents and talking. Imagine the polarization between them. So part of Papua New Guinea, the ones who'd been through school and education, wanting to become more like Australian and beginning to reject their traditional values and the authority of the old people. So you began to see that kind of breakdown in society face to face. It was there right in front of me.
Mm. And you were teaching?
I was teaching.
This was in the late 60s, I presume, was it?
This was 68 to 1972. Okay. But it had its compensations. Mm. I remember every couple of months, I used to take a student. We used to walk half an hour down a jungle track and watch birds of paradise dancing in the tree.
Right.
And this was the Ragiana, where they have the big red tail feathers, with the sun at dawn coming through their tail feathers. It was a glorious sight.
Let's break and have your second track. This is Mozart's Piano Concerto No. 20. Again, what's the significance of this?
Well, when I was at Durham University, I lived in Durham Castle for 2 years, And in the Undercroft, you have the student bar. And this was one of the pieces of music that was always on. I always would put it on when I went to the bar and listen to it. So it reminds me of student days.
Well, we'll have to fade out Mozart there. It's about 9.5 minutes of it. That's Mitsuko Uchida and the Cleveland Orchestra playing The Romance, the second movement from Mozart's Piano Concerto No. 20 in D minor, K466, to be precise. Chosen by John Jackson, my guest in the studio today. John, where we left off, you were in Papua New Guinea teaching, yes. Which was not perhaps the most obvious move from Durham University, but you clearly engaged in it and found it really interesting. What happened next?
Well, one of the aspects of the school, there were 360 students there from 35 different languages boarding, and each student had 400 square yards of garden, and they had to grow their own vegetables to feed themselves, because as a mission school there was not much money and we had a local market to support this. I began to realise that, and I used to go on, you know, long expeditions with the students in the holidays, so I began to realise that by the time they were 13 they could take on serious responsibilities. And I'll elaborate on this later, and this started my interest in young people, is how can you help them use, how can you help society use the responsibilities of young people. And then the Scout Association asked me if I could work full-time with them and three seconded teachers from the Ministry of Education to find a solution to the dropout problem, because there was a very serious dropout problem by this time from the high schools. They'd all gone to high school thinking they'd get a job in the town, and the jobs weren't there, but the families didn't want them back in the village because they just wanted them to send money back to the village. So I spent 3 years working on more community development-oriented programs with dropouts in Leh, in an urban centre, the other side, on the north side of Papua New Guinea. And one of the things I remember, most inspiring things I remember, I think it was about 1974, the country introduced its own currency, the kina. How do you persuade villagers in the mountains that the kina has the same value as the Australian dollar when they think Australia is the future and Papua New Guinea is history? So I worked with the Ministry of Information. We trained 36 young people between the ages of 15 and 20 that I was involved with at the time for 3 days in all about the new currency and the implications and the values, etc. And we sent them out in groups of six by themselves up into the mountains for 3 weeks. So they survived by themselves going from village to village up in the mountains for 3 weeks. We had a radio program each night to supplement it. And I remember when they came back, talking to the youngest, who was 15, he said when he was 10, he left school. He'd been in trouble with the police ever since. And this is the first time he's ever been able to contribute. He felt so good about that. And so did I. I think this was what I was saying. You can capture their sense of responsibility. They can deliver.
Absolutely. Okay. So there was a very worthwhile role for you to undertake there.
Yes.
As an advancement from the teaching you'd been doing.
Yes.
And this was under the auspices of the Scout Association.
Yes, yes.
But then independence came along in 1975.
Yes.
And things
yes.
started to change, didn't they?
I anticipated that Europeans would become less and less welcome. The first Papua New Guinean high school teachers were beginning to come through the system. And so I felt it was time to move on. I'd been away 7 years now. And I'd met the Secretary General of the World Scout Bureau, based in Geneva, when he was visiting. And he offered me a post in Geneva as an assistant director on a new USAID-funded global community development program for the Scout movement. And this involved helping Scout associations in Africa, Arab states and Asia to transform their association into their approach to scouting, to try and capture this responsibility in scouts to contribute to development, to local development. So I started working on that program. I was there 5 years.
You were fully immersed in the scouting movement as an adult, but you hadn't been involved in it as a child, had you?
I'd been a cub once, but no, not really. My parents had been scout master and scout mistress, or cub mistress, but I hadn't, it hadn't switched me on at that time.
No. But you clearly were very involved now in Geneva then, but I imagine this also involved quite a bit of travel to other countries, did it?
Yeah, I'd created a series of manuals that scout leaders and teachers, youth leaders could use to help young people get involved in development. So there was manuals on nutrition and public health and literacy. We ran a series of regional conferences to introduce these ideas. I found a set of monographs on literacy that the Tehran Institute of UNESCO in Tehran, before the revolution, they had produced, and I had captured that and translated into a manual. That was just very academic, so I put that into a manual that teachers could use and scout leaders could use. And as a result of that, UNESCO organised a workshop, and they for the users and for the publisher and for the publisher and for the writers, and there was 20 odd writers, half of them American PhD students. There was a publisher from London and just one user, and that was me, which was really a bad sign for UNESCO.
Yes.
But as a result of that, the World Organisation, World Scout Bureau, got UNESCO's Literacy Prize. Mm. One experience of it working, when India introduced Hindi as a national language, only 15% of the population could read, write, or understand it. So they trained 15-year-old scouts and guides to design and run literacy programs in the villages. And in the first year, 1 million adults went through programs run by 15-year-olds. And I remember in Punjab, in a village, a dozen adults sitting around and three girls in their saris from the village, teaching them and helping them to understand Hindi and speak and write and read. And one of them said to me afterwards, "Do you know, we've never done anything like this before." They felt so good that they were being respected for the first time in their lives. Mm. They felt so good about
That's
it.
That's tremendous, isn't it? Yeah. So you got involved with the UN, and that continued, didn't it? You ended up working still with the UN in Sri Lanka, didn't you?
Yes, I was asked. UN asked me to go and help run a project in Sri Lanka to get young people involved in development on an international basis, a bit like VSO. So the UN had its own system called UN Volunteers. Most of volunteers were higher-level professionals, doctors, lawyers. They tended to be based in towns and therefore had very little impact on villages, and the UN wanted something like VSO that could actually reach village level. And so we were based in Colombo, and we had volunteers, 110 or 20 volunteers from about 11 different countries in Asia, working in other countries at village level, and we were supporting them. And we had one near us in Colombo from Bangladesh. He was a professional youth worker. He living in the village by himself, gradually learning the language. The village gave him a house. And after a year, he felt integrated. The village produced coffee, and they sold it to a middleman. And they were poor, and the children didn't go to school, really, and their clothes were poor. And this volunteer said, "Why don't we refine our own coffee here? Why do we sell it? So we can keep some of the income." And they're a bit reluctant to go against the landlord or the coffee, you know, the owners of the coffee system. But they did. And within months, you could see the children going to school and the wearing cleaner clothes. And I realised what a powerful process it is when you have an agent of change within the village that's integrated like that. Yeah. So I was there 2 years.
We should say that somewhere along the line here, you got married, didn't you? Was that in Sri Lanka or was that before?
That was in Geneva. That was probably the best result of my work with the World Scout Bureau. I was delegated to go to a regional conference in Singapore on urban development and young people and scouting. Scouts of Singapore were organising it. And my wife was on the local staff. Oh, Rabia was on the local staff, and I was only there a week, and we thought it might be fantasy. And then I had to go to Bahrain to run a conference, and I got to the airport, and I asked my Bahraini guests, "Where's the nearest telephone?" And so I telephoned from Bahrain Airport to ask my wife to marry me.
Oh, how romantic.
And she resigned, and 3 months later she flew out to Switzerland, and we came to England and got married. Oh, 1980.
Excellent. Right. Then you went to Sri Lanka.
Yes.
But that only lasted until 1983 because of the Civil War, I believe. Is that right?
Yes. Yeah. 25th of July, 1983. Mm. The Civil War started.
Was that a good time to get out? Is that pretty much what you decided?
No, I was on a 2-year contract. Right. But the experience was quite difficult. Especially for my wife, I ended up in the office on the Monday morning with five or six staff. All the Tamil drivers and the Tamil staff had gone to police stations because they knew something was wrong. And I realised there was no cars on the road, and we realised there was something wrong. So I had to drive my staff home. And I got them all. There's five of them in the little Mitsubishi Colt. Luckily, I had a UN sign on the side of the car, and I got a few hundred yards down the road and I came to the first mob. And they had come in trucks, each with a leader dressed nicely with the electoral register, just targeting Tamil properties because Tamils controlled a high proportion of the commerce, and burning the Tamil properties and the Tamils, anybody inside. So I didn't quite stop soon enough, and they hit the car with an iron rod and looked inside to see if they could see any Tamil faces. Then they said, "I want petrol," because they wanted to use the petrol to burn the properties. And I said, "No, I've got to take these guys home." And I said, "All right." And then I went at the fourth mob, they opened the back door, and there was this young Sinhalese, about 16, who had cut his arm looting. and he'd lost a lot of blood, and he was faint, semi-conscious. So they threw him on the back seat on the laps of the other people, plus a minder to look after him. They said, take him to hospital. And the hospital was 15 miles away, so this was my passport. And I went through 10 mobs like that. Just so, and I, every time I say no to the petrol, I say, I'm taking your guy to hospital. And then coming back, curfew came down. My wife, I didn't know, but my wife knew, and she was a bit worried because I hadn't come back. And I decided not to come back the same way. I'd go back the back streets. And 300 yards before home, there was this little group, five or six people, standing there, and they stopped me. And they looked in, saw I had nobody. And then they said in BBC accent, I don't suppose you could lend us some petrol, do you? I said, no. So when the contract ended, I gave up the UN career idea, and we came back to England.
Okay. Let's have your third record, Stevie Wonder.
When we were engaged, Rabia was in Singapore and I was in Geneva. We used to ring up regularly. And Rabia felt that this song encapsulates those moments.
Oh, fair enough, yes. Well, it's just, I just call to say I love you.
No New Year's Day to celebrate. No chocolate cup of candy hearts to give away. No
Stevie Wonder and I Just Called to Say I Love You from 1984, chosen by John Jackson. John, we got to the point where you had been working in Sri Lanka and you decided to come back to the UK. You then went into local government, didn't you?
Yes. One thing about Sri Lanka, one other thing I didn't say, was that my first daughter Anna was born out there. Had 18 months with us, and we came back as a threesome.
Yes, yes.
I had no idea what I was going to do when I came back to England. I hadn't worked in England before. And I was offered a job with the London Borough of Enfield the day my leave finished, really. So it was very fortuitous. And I was responsible for a programme to get long-term unemployed back into work, financed by the Manpower Services Commission. Had about 1,000 people on the payroll, about 30 coordinators and supervisors. And a job centre. And that's when I realised that people said to me, why are you doing this? They don't want to work. They just like their benefits. But I found 90% of them actually did want to work. They had something to contribute. And you could see after 6 months, if they'd unemployed after six months, you could begin to see the problems arise, the social problems in the family, the health problems, the lack of confidence, the loss of the work ethic. So I felt it was a very valuable programme. And then we had a range of projects throughout Enfield as a community, working with the voluntary sector, with the churches, with the other departments. They did some great stuff.
We're into the 1990s now, I suppose, yes. Are we? When unemployment was a fairly massive problem, wasn't it?
Well, I started in 83. So I was there till 83 to 1990, yes.
I see. So through the Thatcher years, yes. And John Major, which are obviously characterised by... Yes. High unemployment eventually, weren't they? Yes. So there was a big task to do there.
There was. Mm. Unfortunately, the government cut the funding back on the project side and gave much more to the colleges to focus on the training side. And soon after that, I got involved in the Conservative Party then, and went onto the candidates list, and did a couple of selection interviews for London North MEP and for a Coventry seat. But I'd also been recruited by the central government, and so I decided to take the civil service option, and they were more reliable than the electorate. So I had to give up all politics, and I joined the civil service.
I see.
And that was 1990. Yeah.
Was that in London?
In London, in the Department of the Environment, in the old building in Marsham Street.
Oh, I see. Okay. And what was that job?
The first 2 years I had responsibility for land use planning, and I had drafted two or three planning policy guidance notes, which anybody involved in planning would know. They set the parameters in which, within which local authorities make planning decisions. The one I think I felt I did best at was the out-of-town shopping centres, because there was a growing concern about them and the loss of high street capacity. So that was for 2 years. And then I did some financial management work. And then in 1999, I went on to the Office of the Deputy Prime Minister, because local government was focused in the Office of the Deputy Prime Minister. Blair had been elected with a strong mandate to reform local government. I think the Mrs. Thatcher and John Major had not given so much attention to local authorities, and there was a lot of local authorities that were fairly weak in their performance. And Blair wanted, there was a strong reform programme, so I got involved in that.
And this was in the Office of the Deputy Prime Minister, which would have been John Prescott in those days.
It was John Prescott.
But you didn't have a great deal to do with him.
No, he was mainly there for political reasons. Hilary Armstrong was the Secretary of State, if I remember rightly. Right. And then there was half a dozen ministers under her and in the Lords who had portfolios of local government. So we worked across that.
And the Local Government Act of 1999...
I managed that through Parliament. That was a very interesting process, especially because three or four years before, there were three local government associations. They had come together as a single local government association. They were, for the first time, they were able to speak with one voice. And they became a very strong partner with us, and I involved them closely. And then when the Act was passed in 1999, I spent 3 years then working with the LGA as a partner in helping to implement the Act and helping local authorities do better. And one of the things we did together was a leadership peer review programme. I had responsibility from the government side, but it was led by the Local Government Association. And this became a very powerful tool when the leadership of a senior management of a local authority comes face to face with its strengths and weaknesses and acknowledges its weaknesses and is able to do something about them. And also I had responsibility for the Beacon Programme, which was a systematic exchange of best practice amongst local authorities. But the key here was that if you got an award, you're only halfway through the process. That best practice had to become a training vehicle for local authorities for a year. And Nick Rainsford, the minister, was very keen on this and put money into this. So I did that for 3 years, and it was very rewarding because I could see local authorities actually, those that really beginning to take some of this on board and reforming and doing a really good job.
And you were really at the centre of things.
Yeah.
And that must have been quite fascinating at that time.
I was able to see, to know what a good local authority looked like, because you could see travelling around and talking to staff. I remember in one conference, I had to speak at a number of conferences. One of the managers there stood up and said, you know, this is like liberation. For the first time, I can begin to implement ideas that I know can lead to a better service, but I haven't been able to before.
In 2002, though, you ended up in Strasbourg.
Council of Europe in Strasbourg has the function of local government. It's there rather than in Brussels with the European Union. And I was seconded by the ODPM to work there to help Council of Europe develop its own capacity to support, to strengthen local authorities in Eastern Europe. Now, Eastern Europe had, the wall had come down, and around 1995, the first mayors had been appointed, but they really had little idea of democracy and local government as we know it. And this was 2002, so they'd started focusing on the legislative framework, and I was there using UK English experience of local government, because I think by that time England had a lot of global best practice, using that and adapting it for Eastern Europe, and so including, for instance, the best exchange of best practice, the leadership program. I was able to help in the development of two or three local government associations, and gradually build up their institutional capacity.
So based in Strasbourg, but involved in a number of different countries.
Most of the countries of Eastern, yes. Eastern Europe, because Council of Europe covers 47 member states.
Sure. Not just the EU. And again, interesting work?
I loved it because I think partly because we were welcome. They wanted us. The local government associations, that you came across the conflict all the time between the old mentality, where they wanted to have a hierarchy and they were unable to bring out the best of their staff, and it wasn't a very good job working in a local authority in some of those countries at that time. And gradually you see the change working through, and it was very rewarding.
You opted for early retirement in 2006, though. What prompted that?
Well, in 2005, I began to realise I needed to ensure that the work I was doing was, and my team, was sustainable, because at the moment the British government was paying my salary. And so I set up, with the help of a number of member states, we set up what was we call the Centre of Expertise for Local Government Reform. The in a way, it had to go through a process of regional ministers' conference, and they agreed it. Then it had to go to a summit of heads of state, and it was one of four initiatives that the heads of state's conference summit agreed. And it forced the Secretary General to find another €500,000 at a time when he was having to cut €10 million. So I didn't become very popular at the time. And I thought it was time, you know, now the Centre of Expertise had been agreed. I wasn't needed anymore, and they should, Council of Europe should take responsibility. And so I came back to the British government and said...
A natural end point.
Natural end point, and I took early retirement from the British government because I didn't want to move to another job. I wanted to carry on with local government.
That's an appropriate moment to take your fourth track, which is a bit of a favourite on this programme, it has to be said. This is the Elgar Cello Concerto, and, well, no argument from me, it's a great piece, but why have you chosen it?
Well, in Enfield, my second daughter, Angeli, was born. So I have two daughters, Anna and Angeli. And in a way, this is Anna's choice. This is one of her favourites that she thinks I remember and I would like as well. So this is Anna's idea.
Okay, well, let's have a little bit of it.
Thank you.
well. It seems absolutely dreadful having to fade that out. Time is a little bit against us, and that was, of course, Elgar's Cello Concerto with Jacqueline Dupre on the cello. John, you found yourself back in Britain in 2006, having taken early retirement. Was that back in Sherborne, or had you moved to Sherborne at that point?
No, I was still in North London, but I was beginning to wanted to leave London. Having grown up in Hampshire, you know, I was a country boy at heart. But when you look at the prices in South Hertfordshire, they're not much less than London. No. I looked at Hampshire, New Forest, they're not much less than London. And we spent, it was 2011, we finally moved to Sherborne, and we loved it.
In the meantime, you had to find a new career. What was the game plan?
Well, I still had contacts from my Council of Europe days, and while I was in the Council of Europe, I'd worked alongside other organisations like OSCE and the EU, and so I became a private consultant with them. So, and working on short-term assignments. So, I mean, one of them I was working with an organisation called DRI, which is a German international German NGO, to help Jordan introduce its decentralisation programme. I was working in Iraq with the Dutch Local Government Association. They have a big international arm and helping the Iraqis build a local government association. And then later, we had a request from the Baghdad province. There was 15 districts in Baghdad and 100 sub-districts, and they wanted their own local government association. So on and off for a year, we had got them ready for launching local government association, so we planned a big conference. And then the night before, the regional commissioner, i.e. the regional governor, the state man in charge of everything, rang up the district chairman, local government chairman, and said, if you go to this conference, if you launched, I will stop your salary next day.
Yeah.
So we changed the conference into a conference about local government associations. But there was 250 people there. There was 60 press, there was 11 MPs, and all the mayors. And it was really full of buzz. And there's lots of interviews going on all the time, even into the evening. And about 8 o'clock that evening, one of the mayors, he said, you know, I've had enough of this. We will launch our local government association now, tonight. And when we started the conference, we had a moment of about 15 minutes while they flashed up 350 faces of councillors who had been murdered in the last 5 years in sectarian violence. This is the price they're willing to pay for democracy. Mm. And I remember talking to one of the guys, and he said, you know, they killed my father, they killed my brother. I'm going to stand. I'm going to be a mayor. We're going to make this work. And that's, you know, when you think how blasé some people come about voting in this country, you realise, you know, in parts of the world, you die for a vote.
Absolutely.
It's important.
All right, so this was very relevant to what you'd been doing, and you set up something you call the Leadership Academy, and
yes,
that's ongoing, isn't it? You're still doing
yes,
this.
Yes, I am. I came to the conclusion that the most valuable thing I could do was to help mayors change their mindset about working, about raising standards of performance, getting rid of that hierarchy, that fear of the boss, realizing that, and using leadership in our old Anglo-Saxon way. If you ask anybody in Europe what leadership means, generally they'll say it means the people at the top. In France, there's no word for leadership. But here they're saying, no, leadership is the power you have within you. And if you can capture that power of every member of staff, if every manager can capture the power of every member of staff, so they're, instead of giving the typical 40% of their potential, they can give 90, 100% of their potential, you will see huge raising of standards of performance in local authorities. But to change mindset, change values, it's not just a one-off thing. So the Leadership Academy was designed about 3 times 3 days of contact time over 6 months. And they learn from each other, especially. They have to break down their defensiveness. And after 6 months, they really are moved. It's an emotional process. And you see the effect of the Leadership Academy. And I've now introduced that in over a dozen countries. In Ukraine, where I'm heavily involved, I've run 13 Leadership Academies, and other Ukrainian trainers now are running their own Leadership Academy without me, so I'm doing myself out of a job.
So plenty of travelling around still.
Not so much now.
No.
Only 20% of my time now I would do this.
And so in the other 80% of your time, what are you doing with yourself then?
Enjoying Sherburn.
Yes, absolutely.
And I'm skiing every January. I need to keep fit, and I go in the Alps in the summer for a month as well. My wife works in Sherburn. My wife runs the RVS Lunch Club in Sherburn with 35 members and 10 volunteers, and she's very much engaged in Sherburn. There's a lovely team of volunteers she has.
And sailing, I believe, as well.
I have been a sailor, yes. When I came back to London, I bought a boat, a yacht, and had it managed, so it's chartered and it paid for itself. And then in around 2007, a friend of mine, David, and myself, we took it to Tallinn over two seasons. And then, unfortunately, sadly, David had a heart attack. And I got a friend of mine to come and help bring it back 2 years after that. And we were off the Polish coast, 3 weeks sailing out of Tallinn, off the Polish coast. And we had a couple of Poles join us. The forecast was force five, and we were just sailing for 7 hours between harbours, and halfway, force 10, 11 hit us. And the waves went up to 9 metres, and the harbours were dredged to 4 metres, so we couldn't get back into the harbours, otherwise you just hit the bottom. So we told the Coast Guard we would ride out the storm. So we'd left at 10 o'clock that morning, and 3:30 the following morning, I was on the helm with one of the Poles, and the two others were inside, and I heard this snap, and then I was in the water. I just remember green bubbles. And what had happened was that a freak wave must have hit the small bit of sail we had. The boat did a very quick 360 degrees, and the mast was wrapped around the hull. And by the time the two guys inside the saloon got out onto the deck, the two of us from the deck were in the water, 50 yards away. And we had 3.5 hours in that water, and it was a freak storm. The temperature of the water was at a freak high. It was about 19 or 20 degrees.
It probably helped you immensely.
Because normally you have half an hour window.
Yes.
But with these waves, we were underwater 20 seconds every minute, being surfed towards the land, which was 5 miles away, while the boat was being, just pushed along. And the boat hit shore. And then at dawn, the Polish Air Force, a plane started flying looking for us. Then finally found us, and the Coast Guard found us 300 metres from shore,
right.
Picked us up. And had we hit the shore, we wouldn't have survived, because the shore is such that the undertow is such that you can't get out of it.
Yeah.
So the gods were smiling.
So you've been shipwrecked as well.
and great gratitude to the Coast Guard.
Absolutely right. regrettably, we're coming to the end, and we will have to close. What are we going to go out with? Elaine Page.
Yes. Well, nice. I think I always think of the time Rabia and myself, Anna and Anjali, we went to the theatre to see Cats in London. And this was such a memorable song. I wanted something to remember the family with.
John, thank you very much for coming in and telling us your life story, and we wish you every success in the future.
Thank you.